Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, boys, girls, imaginary friends, your pets, everybody, welcome to WFHR's Director's Cut for this session number 52, I believe, Seth.
Mm-hmm, that is correct.
Your host and program director here, James J. Maloff, joined by my partner in art, our head of production, Seth Habhager.
Welcome, one and all, back to Director's Cut. We have another movie episode, I guess you could say. These are the ones that we're going to be doing just so we can fulfill our podcast. Podcast dreams.
Yes. And it's a spotlight kind of for us.
It is.
Us a chance to put a spotlight on movies that maybe you've heard of, maybe mm-hmm. you haven't, mm-hmm. maybe give you something fun to watch this weekend.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. So we have no rhyme or reason for these movies that we're choosing. Mm. We are just going out and think, hey, this would be a fun movie to talk about. And then, you know, watching it, doing a little research, you know, stuff we love to do. We love, I don't know if people figure that out, that we love to research stuff.
For those that don't know, yes, we're research hounds. We love movies. We love talking about these things, and we know that a lot of you do out there as well. Thanks mm-hmm. so much for spreading the word about the show, and keep in mind, we are always looking for guests for our show.
That's right.
If you're a creative out there, reach out to Seth or I. You can reach out to us through our Facebook pages or through our email, either james.maloff@civicmedia.us or seth.habhager@civicmedia.us. Reach out to us and get on the show.
Actually, if you have a movie you want to talk about, we'll even do that with you. So
it's
even
good stuff.
You don't have to be an artist. We just want to talk about all things art. That's what we do on this show. So
we're looking forward to over the next couple of weeks having on a lot of our Civic Media family members
well.
We're going to have them on as part of our Civic series. We've got some artists that we're looking forward to talking to as well,
mm-hmm.
and we're looking forward to a lot of that, and looking forward to talking with you.
That's right,
Seth. Would you mind getting the ball rolling here?
Let's do it. I'm going to be talking about a film that has some relevance to this area coming up at the turn of the new year. We'll get into that a little bit later. But I'm talking about 1944's Arsenic and Old Lace.
Oh, one of my favorites. Oh, good choice.
Directed by Frank Capra, starring, of course, Cary Grant in a unusual role for him. That was a little bit, and we'll talk a little bit about that too, kind of the fallout from all of that. Mm-hmm. But we kind of got to start at the beginning with this one. It started out as a stage play, a hugely successful stage play, I might add, that opened in 1940, ran for over 1,500 performances, several years. It was really a surprise, considering the subject matter of the play itself. So I do have to talk a little bit about the play before we get to the movie, so people can understand, you know, what was the big fuss was about.
Mm-hmm.
So Joseph Kesselring was the credited playwright on this.
Nice.
Now, he did write the first draft, and it was based on a true story. Like so many things, it was based on a lady that had a boarding house, and she had people come in, and then she murdered them.
Yeah.
She was a mass murderer, at least 32 confirmed, maybe as many as 64 people. And it was big news back in the 1930s. So this was based on Mr. Kesselring. Used that as he was kind of a failed playwright. He'd done a couple of shows that didn't really go anywhere. So he wrote based on this. So a couple of producers. Long-time Hollywood producers, or excuse me, not Hollywood, but Broadway producers, decided to take a flyer on it, and they said, "Okay, we'll you know, give you some money. You can write the play." He wrote the play, and it wasn't very good. It was pretty dismal. By the way, the names of the producers were Lindsay and Krause. Those are the two last names of the two producers. Lindsay was also actually an actor, and that plays into this a little bit as well. So they basically took the script and rewrote it.
Huh.
Before, it was not a comedy. It was just a pretty much kind of a downer, you know, mystery play with this old lady murdering people, these two old ladies murdering people. Mm-hmm. So they kind of turned it into the comedy, a dark comedy, to be sure. And that's how they went with it. The cast is great for it. In fact, three of the members of the stage play would end up in the movie with Frank, directed by Frank Capra, like I said. The two old ladies, Jean Adair and Josephine Hull, they made the transition to the film, as well as John Alexander, who played Teddy. He would also be in the film. Now, the star of the show, the Broadway show, the name above the marquee was Boris Karloff. Mm. Boris Karloff, of course, plays Jonathan Brewster, who is a mass murderer as well.
Yeah.
Mortimer was not really considered like the main character. It was kind of an ensemble cast for the play. Mm. This not only was Boris Karloff hired to be the one character, and this is the weird thing about it. They hired him just because there's a line in the show that says, He said I looked like Boris Karloff. So they decided to go ahead and take a swing. Hey, Boris, you want to do this? He immediately said no. He had not been on the stage in like 30 years, and it had been in the, like he said, in the sticks back when he was in England. Mm-hmm. And he was very nervous about going on stage on Broadway in his 50s, and he hadn't done it in a long time. He wanted to make sure there were three more strong characters in there, which there were. There's Mortimer, and there's the two aunts. So that they kind of solved that one. Very generously, the producers also cut him in on the deal. So that he would get a part of the receipts of the thing, which made him a lot of money in the end because it was such a big hit. So they convinced him to do it. I got to give Boris Karloff a lot of credit here. He was a wreck during rehearsals. Starting thing, he was so nervous about it. He lost a whole bunch of weight because apparently he had diarrhea for 3 weeks when the show started. Wow. That's how nervous he was. The show was a huge success, partially because of him. He was the top billed because he was the famous guy in there. But he always insisted the ladies get the final bow, which was really cool.
That's epitome of his career, too.
I mean, this is a gentleman through and through.
Yeah, his whole career.
This is who he was.
He was only a monster on stage.
That's right. That's the only time he played. He was a sweet, sweet guy otherwise. So, of course, Hollywood comes knocking, Warner Brothers, to be specific. They got the rights to the play because they knew this was a big hit, and they wanted to go ahead. Now, before I get into the movie part, let's do a little bit about the plot to make sure those who have not seen it. I'm going to say no spoilers. The movie opened in 1944. I mean, I'm going to try not to because I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that haven't seen it before. So I won't reveal some of the twisty parts of it, I guess.
But I do think that when we're talking about these movies, keeping in mind, if you haven't seen them, maybe listen to the show after you've seen the movie or something.
That's a great point.
Because there are going to be spoilers when we're dissecting these movies. We almost have to.
Yeah.
And I hate spoilers.
Yeah.
But it's gonna happen. And again, 1947. I mean, it's been a while for a while.
It's been a while. But anyway, so the plot is basically you have a theater critic played by Cary Grant in the film, who is the bachelor against marriage. He ends up getting married. He goes back to Brooklyn. By the way, the setting is on Halloween night. Mm-hmm. And I think it doesn't play a lot into it, but the whole macabre feeling of the show.
Yeah.
He goes back to see his aunts before he leaves, and he finds out they have been murdering old gentlemen who feel are lonely and everything. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a guy that comes in and they try to murder him while he's there. And he's like, what? He doesn't look like he really wants to be murdered.
Yeah,
so
this
is very, very gray area here. Mm-hmm. Mortimer freaks out, understandably, that he finds out his aunts have killed a whole bunch of people. Farcical things ensue. His murderous brother shows up, his crazy older brother, to add to the hijinks, along with a Dr. Einstein, brilliantly played by Peter Lorre. Oh. Man never had a bad performance in his life.
No.
And it's very funny. There's some tense parts in it and everything. It's a great movie. You can't really explain. I mean, that's the basic of the plot. You want to see it because there's just lots of craziness that goes along with it. You've got the uncle who believes he is Teddy Roosevelt. Through the whole thing. And that plays into the aunts murdering people and everything. I do have to say they changed the ending for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had to.
Yeah.
Back at this time, you could not end a movie with people getting away with a crime.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they had to change the ending. Because in the play, well, again, no spoilers, it's a little bit different. So they did have to change it. Now, I said before there were three people from the cast of the Broadway show that ended up in the movie. Where's Boris Karloff?
Mm.
Movie star. Should have been in it kind of thing. Well, it was very convoluted that what happened. The producers of the Broadway show was still running at the time when they were filming, by the way.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that part.
That really plays hard into it. Now, they gave the two aunts, and they gave Teddy, the actor who played Teddy, they gave them a leave of absence so they could go and come back.
That's so cool.
They could actually do that, which is really – I mean, I have to say that the producers on this show were like – they're not like – Broadway producers I've heard before, they're like really nice
yeah.
stuff like that. But anyway, so Boris Karloff ends up not being in the movie. He really wanted to be in the movie. He couldn't do it because of the contract he was in for the Broadway show, and they couldn't work out a deal with Warners. If they had waited a little bit longer, they could have gotten him to start filming. They could have gotten Boris Karloff. Unfortunately, Frank Capra was under a deadline. He was going to go into the U.S. Signal Corps for World War. This was during World War II, of course, you have to remember. And so he had a limited time. He wanted to get it in the can before he had to go overseas or start to work for the Army, basically. So that was where the mess came in. So they ended up hiring Raymond Massey. Now, in my opinion, the weakest part of the movie is Raymond Massey. Yeah. Excellent actor. He plays Abraham Lincoln in a movie, does a wonderful job of it, but he looks like Abraham Lincoln. Yeah. Yeah. They tried to make him look more like Boris Karloff. They keep the joke in there, you know. He gets angry because people compare him to Boris Karloff. That's why he kills people, is because they say that. Yeah. And it just doesn't work quite as well. No. It would have been a coup to get Boris Karloff to actually do it. Really interesting couple of notes here about that whole thing. One of the things they tried to do to work it out is who would take over for Boris on Broadway if he was come to the 8 weeks so he could film the movie. Hmm. At the time, Humphrey Bogart was a big star at Warner's. This was 1941 when he had his breakout, The Maltese Falcon and High Sierra. Those were two of his breakout movies. They were actually thinking of having Humphrey Bogart play the role of Jonathan during those 8 weeks when Boris Karloff was filming the movie.
Completely different movie.
Can you imagine?
I'm having a hard time, but I mean, that is really interesting. Huh.
It's a fascinating thing. One other note about about Cary Grant accepting the role. They actually were originally going to cast an unknown as Mortimer, but they end up going with Cary Grant. Okay, this is really cool. Of course, this is during the war. His Cary Grant's fee for the movie was $160,000. Okay. Which was pretty standard for a big star back then. Doesn't seem like a lot now, but, you know, it was big. Not like the millions they get now, but still, that's a big chunk of money in 1941, 42. He only took $50,000 for himself. The rest he donated to causes for the war effort. Yeah. $110,000.
That's part of why he's one of my favorites.
I mean, that is remarkable, thinking how much money he left on the table. Or put to good use because the war was going on. It's a really remarkable. So the movie comes out, of course. It's a big hit. And the rest is history. Now, after the film, after he saw it, Cary Grant was not thrilled with his performance. Yeah. He felt it was a little too much over the top. He felt he was doing some mugging, and he really didn't like it. Now, if you watch it today, there's some moments there where he plays it so well. His eyes are, you know, he's popping his eyes kind of thing. And I think that's probably part that the thing he didn't like about it. It was a very different role for him. This is not the kind of Cary Grant you see in so many other movies. And I think part of that was that. And I think he, if I remember correctly, did hold a little bit of a grudge against Frank Capra for not reining him in a little bit.
Only director he ever did, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Be that as it may, there are some people who absolutely adore his performance. I think it's good. I absolutely do think it's good. The performance by the two aunts, Jean Adair and Josephine Hull, is fabulous. Oh, my gosh. They are so good in
flawless.
That. You can tell how they did that. The other, Teddy, of course, John Alexander playing Teddy. He is fabulous in it. They're so good at these roles because they played it for so many performances. And the other standout is really Peter Lorre as Dr. Einstein. I love Peter Lorre. I can't help it, but he's just so good at this. And the rest of the other characters in it, the cab driver, he's hilarious throughout the whole movie. Some of the bit players in there, but altogether, it's a fun movie. Check it out. You know, Halloween season is here. You know, have some fun. The interplay between Cary Grant and his leading lady is fun too. So it's a different kind of show. It's not what you expect from the 1940s. It really isn't that kind of dark comedy, and at times it gets really. It's like, whoa, how did they let this through? It must have been because it was during the war.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
let more stuff slide then.
Yeah.
But the only, like I said, the only weak part is kind of Raymond Massey as Jonathan. He does have some parts where he does is very menacing.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it would have been better with Boris Karloff.
Well said. And perfect movie to touch on. I love that you covered this one, Seth. I will mention you and I are not the only ones that love this movie. And this movie has a lot of personal ties for me. I think of this movie and I immediately think of my Nana, my grandmother, mm-hmm. who I was 7, 8 years old watching this movie with her. And I can remember even back then thinking, this is dark for an older movie. I think it's a credit to audiences, to people that made this so successful, mm-hmm. that they were able to take a subject matter that is dark and find some humor in it. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a coincidence that the movie was successful during a time when we were worried about going to war, and there was already a dark Cobb kind of feel in the country, in the world.
That's a good point.
So that looking for a laughter, but something that would segue into that, a dark comedy would mm-hmm. do that pretty well. A couple of noteworthy things about the movie. To this day, it has an 86% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Not
which
bad.
Which is very impressive for not only an older movie, but any movie to have a successful ranking.
That's true, yeah.
IMDb, it has an 8 out of 10 and a very noteworthy,
that's almost
I
more
think.
Impressive, but yeah, that's cool. Yeah,
it's pretty cool. You did a great job of going through the cast. I would like to shout out Priscilla Lane as the Mortimer's the Elaine, the lead.
Yep.
I always felt I'm not bad for her. She knows what she signed up for. And as somebody who you know and I know, when you work with a big cast and great actors, sometimes you don't stand out. That's okay. You're mm-hmm. just happy to be working with these great performers, as she was. But I feel like her performance gets lost in the shuffle with all the great names you mentioned there. And they're at 10s. And she's at a 9.5, a 9, mm-hmm. which is still great, but it just doesn't stand out like it could have with other casts. It always... I studied and looked up to Cary Grant, one of the oldest actors I've done that with, mm-hmm. and him, Sidney Poitier. I've studied so much and watched interviews with them. And even as a young teenager, when I would finally come across the interviews and he'd talk about this movie, it almost hurt me a little bit because I love his performance so much, to the point that it's top 3 dream roles for me.
Mm.
I want this mm-hmm. role because of loving it with Cary Grant and everything and thinking of my Nana having the best seat in the house to be able to watch me play Mortimer or something like that. There are certain things about it that bring me to it, but I also think there's some really cool facts about the movie that may not be known, and you touched on all the really some really good ones there. Mm-hmm. I think, but one of the interesting notes, the whole movie was the total darkness was used for the cellar scenes in order to create a spooky atmosphere during the scenes set
in the
cellar. The production team decided to film it in total darkness with only minimal lighting, which it's difficult to do that nowadays, mm-hmm. let alone back then. You mentioned it being a box office success. That is noteworthy, again, with the time in America we're at.
Mm-hmm.
People weren't going to the movies. People weren't doing
a
lot as much and stuff. Yeah. The Burris sisters' famous line had to be redubbed. I'll knock off your pretty head. That actually had to be redubbed post-production due to concerns about a violent connection.
Right.
Some of that. President Teddy Roosevelt inspired the character, of course, of Teddy Brewster.
Mm-hmm.
And it's noted that the family enjoyed that, enjoyed the performance and everything.
That's good to know.
But I think the most standout thing about this that stood out to me, at least, that I did not know until I would say over the last year or two that I had heard about this, Peter Lorre initially wanted the Mortimer Brewster role. And,
oh, wow.
And he was gunning for this like no role he has ever gunned for before.
Mm-hmm.
The iconic actor, Peter Lorre, thought that this role could change his legacy, could change the way he was looked at and remembered and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted it so badly. When he heard that Cary Grant was getting the part, he bowed his head. He's like, okay. Which I think is really cool and really impressive
mm-hmm.
in a time when you would think of a lot of egos and divas.
Right.
Not the case. In fact, the two loved working together and worked very well together. And Peter Lorre is still, of course, as you noted, in the film and does an amazing job in the film.
Another one of those monsters only on a screen. From all accounts, Peter Lorre was another very sweet, sweet man.
Yeah.
A very lovely person. I mean, I guess you got to be on that side to play a really despicable people, right?
It does seem to be the way. Yeah. I'm so glad you mentioned the sisters, because if you've heard me once talk about acting, you probably heard me ramble like I probably just did and didn't even know it. I think of somebody tells me who's the greatest actor I've ever seen, I think of two people right away: Sidney Poitier, Cary Grant.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even separate the two. I don't know who I would say is better than the other. So to think of Cary Grant as this amazing performer, and to me, he is out-acted so many times in this movie by those sisters, Jean, yes. Josephine, incredible performances from them. Yep. Them alone, I think, is worth watching this movie.
100%. Absolutely.
It's not only that, that good, Seth. I think it's so good. Watch the movie and come see the play when it is going to be performed here in Wisconsin Rapids.
We did have a little bit of an ulterior motive for this because, it's going to be the spring or the winter, I should say, the winter show coming up in March, I believe. And that will be so you get to see the difference. You can watch the movie and then you can come see the show and see the differences between the two, because they are pretty marked for censorship reasons, of course, because mm-hmm. there were certain things in the play they couldn't do on screen at the time. Yeah. Which today we would be like, what? They weren't allowed. What? Why? It was a different time, especially in Hollywood back in those days. So there's that fun part of it, too. Absolutely. I mean, it's not only was it a smash play, it was a smash movie, which doesn't happen as much as you'd think.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in the end, both of them worked out really good. And in a lot of ways, it's also effort, to turning to Frank Capra real quick. It's a little bit of an oddball in his oeuvre.
I was going to talk about that.
Well, because he was known for, Yankee, especially at the time, Yankee Doodle Dandy. Before that, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, After the War, Wonderful Life, those kind of movies, more sentimental and stuff like that. Yeah. This was really a weird one in his film career. And partially, maybe it was because it was rushed. For those who know, after he joined the Army, he made a series of films called Why We Fight. Yeah. And they were propaganda films. Propaganda mm-hmm. doesn't have to be bad. Remember that, everybody.
Right.
About why to get people up, why the reasons that the world, why the U.S. was fighting in the war. Remembering that before the war, the United States was very much isolationist. Yes. And so they still needed to convince some people there was a reason to do this. So really, it's a good all-around picture. Different, like I said, different performance from Cary Grant, a different kind of film for Frank Capra. They come together to do this, but it's a good one.
Be sure to look for Arsenic and Old Lace. You can find it online. I know I have recently. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think where I watched it online. I want to double check that. Just if we're telling people about the movie, you can find it on YouTube. It's easy to find right there. You mm-hmm. can find it. You can even check out the trailer if you want on YouTube. I do see it. It is available there. So go ahead and check that out. And
you can also get the DVD from the library, which is how I saw it. Yeah. So don't forget, they have it at the library.
Nicely
too.
Nicely done. Yeah. We are on the same page. I was going to say that. And I was going to lead that into, of course, Wisconsin Rapids Community Theater performing this. The audition dates, if you'd like to be a part of it, are December 16th and 17th. The performances will kick off February 27th and go into March.
Okay.
Find out more at wrctheater.org, wrctheater.org. Get your tickets now.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap up this part. We're going to take a little break, come back, and we're going to talk about the movie James has. Cliffhanger, teaser, when we come back to Director's Cut.
Welcome back to Director's Cut, everyone. This is our Spotlight series where Seth and I are taking different movies that maybe you've heard of, maybe you haven't, and maybe you will add to your to-do list to watch.
I think so.
Seth had a great one to kick us off with, Arsenic and Old Lace. Appreciate that, Seth. I'm going to go a little bit of a different direction with The Complete Library of Robin Williams. No, I'm joking. I think that's where the audience probably thought I was going to go, as a Robin Williams movie.
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. But that'll be the next one. Yeah. But for now, I want to focus on 2002's Equilibrium. This is a science fiction film written and directed by Kurt Weimer, starring Christian Bale, Emily Watson, Taye Diggs. Sean Bean has a small performance in it.
Ooh.
The film follows Bale as John Preston, an enforcement officer in a future in which feelings and artistic expression are outlawed, in a society where its citizens are forced to take a psychotic drug to suppress their emotions. After accidentally missing a dose, Preston awakens and begins to uncover the suspicions, inner workings of all of this. So this movie takes place after the survivors of World War III are in this city, this Totalian city. And they blame human emotion for all the conflict, all the turmoil in life. So they figure we're going to take this drug and it's going to get rid of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Along with that, they don't want anything to spark emotion. So they get rid of all art, all movies, all music, all of these things. We are just a society that survives to survive.
Okay.
There is, of course, obviously a human interest in this where you as a viewer watching this are, you know, horrified almost by this utopian future and everything.
Right.
It certainly has tie-ins to classic books and many different things. It's definitely influenced by those.
Mm-hmm. Dystopian, there's a whole section of dystopian novels and stories that you could draw from for this.
But there's certainly some great storylines there, and without like spoiling too much or anything like that, the character of Christian Bale really does awaken, and because it's Christian Bale and you have such a fine, strong actor and a young Christian Bale at the note,
it's true.
He is able to there's a scene where his mind and his feelings are awakening, and he hears music for the first time. And it's Beethoven, and you see the emotion slowly pour over his face, and this moment where he's basically crying because he's so moved by this. But then you see, because it's Christian Bale, again, a great actor, you see him enjoying this and being taken by this, and in those tears starting to realize, what have I missed? What have I missed? He's playing a character in his 30s at this point, gone 30 some years of his life with no human emotion, no music, no movies, no TVs, any of this. And it really, it just so well acted. I do believe that whether it is because of this performance or it is, it just helped. You don't get Christian Bale as Batman without this performance.
Really?
I strongly believe that. Right. It was
only a couple of years later when he started that, yeah.
Right. You don't have him as the Dark Knight without this, and I love the Dark Knight. I love those movies, and I think that that's a big part of this. The concept is very interesting and very, I think, modern time to where almost, whether you're listening to this episode of ours in 2024 or 2042 or whatever it is, it's noteworthy. There's some other cool stuff about this movie, too. Not only do you see fine actors in action roles, which is something that was a precursor to the superhero movement we've seen with Benedict Cumberbatch playing Doctor Strange and Helen Mirren and Shazam 2 and these things. But there's something else that happens with this movie where you have The Matrix and you have the success of a Bullet Time and the filming of that and everything. Mm-hmm. Equilibrium had no budget, and we'll get on to more of that later. So how do you make a movie interesting? How do you make an action movie interesting? The director and the writer came up with this thing called gun kata, or gun fu, if you will. And it's basically through analysts of thousands of recorded gunfights, a cleric, Christian Bale's character, the people that are basically the police of this time, a cleric determines that the geometric distribution of antagonists in the gun battle is statistically predictable element. So basically knowing where the bullet's going to be before where it's going to be.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Each position represents a minimal kill zone, so they're able to be in a certain, like, for example, the opening scene, Christian Bale comes into a dark room that they filmed in the black, similar to Arsenic and Old Lace, and there's about 20 people surrounding him. And he slides in there, and he knows right where to stand, right where to be to avoid every single bullet.
Wow. Wow.
Not only that, but it also, but the cleric also knows where to shoot their bullets and what position and where to be to position the gun and the bullet to where to quickest damage without one bullet kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
No missed shells. There's
right.
no cleric.
No wasting, right?
Yes. They're not emptying their clip. It's one bullet and it hits the mark. It's fascinating to watch them do this. Again, they didn't have the budget. They didn't have the thousands of cameras, literally thousands of cameras they use on the Matrix movie to do Bullet Time and everything. For those that don't know, Bullet Time is done with about, say, for example, 100 cameras surrounding Keanu Reeves on a rooftop and him bending backwards, and they film that. And then it's almost like the old game we used to play on notebooks where you'd make a little picture on each one.
Flip book, yeah. It moves when you flip the pages, right?
It's basically that done with film.
Oh, that's right.
Essentially what Bullet Time is. They didn't have that kind of budget, so they have this gun kata. And the way that Bale and Taye Diggs and they play these roles, it's so believable. It sounds a little, well, obviously made up, but they do this so darn well. It's incredible. There is a scene, I mentioned the Beethoven scene that is moving in that. The final thing that finally gets him is, along with entertainment, we also don't have animals. No more pets. Pets
wow,
bring
okay.
enjoyment. Pets create emotions. So no more pets. Christian Bale comes across a puppy. And long before John Wick, he, with again, not spoiling anything, yep. he chose to save the puppy over other people and himself in many ways. And it really creates the no going back moment in this. The movie is incredible in the fact that it is one of those movies that's all leading up to the big battle. And again, I don't want to spoil anything for people that haven't seen the movie, but it comes down to Bale and Taye Diggs and all this. And Taye Diggs plays an excellent villain. You don't get to see him play a villain very often.
No, you don't.
He does it well. He's so good in it. The scene ends in seconds. And it never happens. That never happens. We'll have more on why that is later.
Oh, wow.
But
okay.
It was so cool to watch. As you're as an action lover, and you're used to every single movie leading up to the big fight that lasts at least 5-10 minutes.
Right.
And boom. Nah, not this time. That's how good Christian Bale's character is, man. Not since James Bond has someone made a white suit look cool. And Christian Bale does this in this. To the point, again, I don't want to spoil anything, but he goes through towards this end battle with Taye Diggs, like 30, 40 guys. By the time he gets to Taye Diggs, not a drop of blood on him. Nothing. Completely white suit. Like, just speaking to what the cleric is able to do and how good he is at this. A last battle that is memorable for a more original ending than so much the fight that they do.
Right.
And one of the things that is unique about this movie is the lack of budget, but the energy and the time that they put into this, the writer, the director, the editors, so much of the filmography, the choreography that goes into an action movie like this, let alone you're doing something nobody has ever done in film with the gun kata stuff. So going over that and everything, and no budget. And these actors were not paid a whole lot or anything like that. It's really cool to see all of that energy, and it's so obvious in the movie. It's so obvious that they care about this. They got this script. They really like this and everything. Right. And, well, Taye Diggs has a pretty okay career here at this point. Sean Bean does.
Of course.
Emily Watson, doing okay. Nobody is necessarily a big-name star, so they're hungry. You know, they're hungry, and you can tell, too. And that comes across in the movie as well. I think that for a movie that does not have a great budget and is a little maybe dated in some things, it holds up in so many big categories. And it's such a even if you watch it one time, I think it's worth a one-time watch. There are some kind of cool, like, little facts about this movie that I thought were kind of interesting about it. The director Kurt Weimer and producer Lucas Foster basically created this gung-fu, this whole different style of fight.
Right.
That, I mean, just imagine that you and I try to sit down and create, hey, let's do something in an action movie nobody's ever done.
Yeah, why
not? Let's go ahead and try that.
What can we do with guns?
Yeah. it's really kind of cool how they do that. That opening scene I mentioned was filmed in an old army barrack in East Germany. They had trouble filming it because they had no lighting. They had no, like, budget for lights.
Right, exactly.
So that's
and
part
of, like, to light a warehouse, that's a lot of lights. Oh my gosh.
The film was never given part of the reason it is a kind of cult classic, indie favorite, one of those movies. You hear people talk about, hey, what's an underrated movie? And this is one of the first ones I like to bring up of our generation.
Right.
The film was never given a wide release because overseas sales were not good. And they got afraid over here of how that might do. John Preston, Christian Bale's character. I almost said Colin Farrell for some reason.
Well, wait a minute.
I don't know. That would have been a completely different movie.
Yeah, it would have been.
John Preston kills 118 characters in the movie, which makes him responsible for exactly half of the total 236 deaths in the movie.
Oh,
as of recently, as far as I could tell, he continues to hold the third place record for most deaths in a movie caused by a character.
Oh my gosh.
It's incredible. And it's all like beautifully done. Like, the action in the movie is done in an artistic way while also being everything you love about action scenes.
Right, right.
The final fight scene that I mentioned before about Christian Bale and Taye Diggs was supposed to actually be much longer, but Diggs, the most popular actor at the time of this crew, had a busy schedule. So they wouldn't, and he wanted to stay again. He loved this project, but wasn't able to stay on it. So they had to kind of cut the fight scene by a little bit and everything, which is kind
of funny how that works.
It's so interesting. When you do watch this movie, and again, I really do encourage you to, this will stand out more. It might not mean as much right now. No wires were used in this movie. So everything you see is done by the actors. There's no special editing. There's no, you know, special effects or green screen or anything. Again, didn't have the money for that. So it's just even more impressive to me these years later when I go back and watch it and I'm like, my God, they did this. The actors did this. The great cinematographer did this and everything. During post-production, the film began to run out of money.
Oh no!
So some of the scenes did not have the special effects to them. You can see this in a few scenes where men are shot in guns with by guns, but no blood comes out. That's kind of done. And I think all of this coming back to, and I mentioned the budget so many times, to not lower expectations, but to increase the charm of this movie, that they're able to pull all of this off, and it's so believable with no budget. It comes down to great character work and character development, wonderful directing, and something we don't get to know nearly enough. Great stage work, great like setup, the location settings that they chose and everything. All of that builds to the movie so well. Francis Ford Coppola, one of my favorite directors of all time, I remember him talking about this. Every movie he does is the same. Budget, 100% of the budget. I'm going to take 70 to 80% of it. I'm going to spend it on costumes, setting, all of that. The actors will get the rest. Yeah, and it's part of the reason that you see like so many big name actors that have wanted to work with him and work with him on a cheaper paycheck than they've ever worked before.
Right.
Because he put so much into this in his movies, whether they're good or bad, whatever you might think, they are believable. They put you in that time frame because he knows how to set up a scene. He knows how important that is. And I think Weimer, I think some of the director, some directors now, they get that too.
Right. And it seems, well, and when you don't have a big budget, you have to be inventive. And like every penny counts. You have to make sure all the setups are nice, all good, ready to go. You know, can't do too many takes. Again, which is harder for an action film, considering, you know, everything that goes in it. Otherwise, if the setup isn't good, if it doesn't come up, then you're going to end up with a bunch of quick cuts, which people notice. And that doesn't look as good. And that's because if you got a whole bunch of quick cuts in a fight scene, it's like, oh, what's this? You know, what happened with the filming on that kind of thing? So that's very important for all that. You know, a couple of things I noticed when you were describing it to me. There's a couple of shout outs in this movie to some iconic things and some other science fiction films. Mm-hmm. The Beethoven, probably a shout out to Clockwork Orange.
Yes.
Which plays a very important part in that movie. Mm-hmm. Also, the animals part of it, too, as well. That is a callback to Blade Runner. More specifically, the story that it's based on, androids dream of electronic sheep? Because they play a huge part in the society in that story by Philip K. Dick. So I'm guessing that has a shout-out to that as well. Also, a note about what the characters are called, clerics, and that the fact they wear white, that is a very specific religious reference. A cleric is another name for a pastor or a minister or a priest. A cleric is a holy person, quote-unquote holy person, that is supposed to, you know, be, you know, supposed to... Not that they are, you know, better than humans, but, you know, they usually are held up on a higher level, like, you know, they should be more... compassion or whatever, they kind of turn that on its head with making the clerics the people who enforce the, you know, no emotion.
That's very interesting.
Law like that. So I found that kind of curious too, and a very interesting choice, especially with, like you said, wearing the white. It's very evocative.
Very certainly a note to the Thought Police of 1984.
Yep, that too. Yep.
Definitely a big influence. Fahrenheit 451.
Yeah,
huge influence. There's some beautiful moments with where Sean Bean's not in the movie very long, but he does some of his greatest acting in this movie. And I think that's saying
high
something.
Praise.
He's a good actor. He has a scene where he quotes a famous quote, and it's to this day when I hear the quote, I hear Sean Bean reciting it.
Not a bad voice though.
No,
I love his voice too. So.
One does not simply walk it. He's got that voice, man. He's got that voice.
I love Sean Bean.
I do want to shout out as much as I'm talking about these other actors and everything. One of my favorite, and I think one of the more underrated actors of her generation, is Emily Watson. And
yes,
I want to note her performance in this. It's again, she's not in the movie as much either, but her performance is noteworthy. It's one of my favorite of her career, and I feel that's saying something. She's just such a wonderful actress, and I feel like she just has never gotten her flowers, and I really want her to.
No, this was at the high point, I think, in her career around the late 90s, early 2000s. Yeah. She was in Gosford Park, had a great role in that as well, but she was in a lot of other movies too. That was kind of the height of her. I don't want to say popularity because she's, of course, continued to work and everything, but of her known quantity, I guess, that people would know who she was.
This movie made $5.3 million in the box office. Like nothing. Not really. Not then, not now, not when Arsenic came out. That just ain't a lot of money.
That's why you probably have never heard of it, because it wasn't a big smash hit. It's what you would call a sleeper, I think, in the business.
It's part of the reason why Seth and I came up with and wanted to do this kind of show where we get to put a spotlight on these certain movies, whether it's an older movie that maybe you hadn't heard of, mm-hmm. and just kind of got lost in the shuffle with the billions of movies that come out every year, or it's a movie that was a great movie that just got lost in the shuffle, whether it was because of studio heads or the times or whatever the reasons
was wrong
might be.
Or whatever. Yeah, exactly.
Film is fun. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, a movie like this, especially where it's not a 3-hour epic or anything, you watch it, you don't like it. It's not the end of the world. You watch it and you like it. It's a movie you come back to the rest of your life, like I have since high
mm-hmm.
school.
Mm-hmm. I want to quick touch on a little after
high school.
Yeah, a little after. Right.
I was going to say,
how old were we in the 20s then? I want to highlight, this is like you'd mentioned at the, right before, this was a couple years before Christian Bale did The Dark Knight, started the Batman mm-hmm. Trilogy with Christopher Nolan. There was also a movie that came out like a year or two after that. Because I would say Christian Bale first hit, big. He was a child actor, was mm-hmm. in several movies. He was in Newsies. He was in Empire of the Sun. He was that. So his adult career kind of started in 2000 with American Psycho.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a controversial movie. Yeah, yeah. And he had a big part in it. He had a really great performance by him. And then that's kind of what launched him. And then he started doing not necessarily what you would think you would do. He does The Equalizer.
Yeah.
He does The Machinist. Which,
oh my God!
Which I'm surprised he didn't die from that.
He's lucky he didn't. Yeah,
I mean the amount of weight he lost for that. It's a fascinating movie. It's kind of hard to watch, but it's a good
one of
movie.
The toughest movies I've ever had to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But not without its merits, of course.
Yes, worth watching.
But so he had kind of the steady stream, and then of course in 2005, Batman Begins. And he becomes Christian Bale. That's kind of when he hits it. And he's been with us, as a big one, an A-lister ever since then. Yeah. So
I was going to bring up The Machinist. I'm really glad you brought that one up. It's one of the greatest acting performances I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And it's one of the hardest movies I've ever seen.
Yeah.
But definitely worth a watch, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a sneaky good movie, and I don't know, a little more fun than The Machinist, at least, The Prestige with him and Hugh Jackman.
Oh, yeah. Another great one.
Such a great movie mm-hmm. and such great performances. You've got David Bowie playing Nikola Tesla. You've got obviously Jackman and Bale doing such an amazing mm-hmm. job going back and forth wise. They have such good chemistry in that movie. These are the kind of things, too, where it's not just I wanted to focus on the movie, but then it also reminds me, man, Christian Bale's good. We normalize some of these things mm-hmm. and stuff, but he's better than your average actor. He's far better than I think I even gave him credit for until kind of taking a step back and looking at his career, the work that he's done. Mm-hmm. You gave us a perfect timeline. You sit back and like, man, that guy done some good work in his career.
Yeah, he really has. It's been a real varied one, too. He seems like a restless person. In that in a good way.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to keep doing the same thing over and over. That's why he'll take chances. That's why he'll be in a Marvel movie. He'll be Gore, the villain in the Thor movie. Or, like you said, or The Machinist, where he loses a whole bunch of weight. Or, it was a risk-taking Batman.
Yep.
Because I remember when that started, people were like, Batman again? Are we doing this again?
Right.
Well, we did it with the Christopher Nolan way, which is a little different. But again, and he just knocked it out of the park. So, there's been some stuff. We've all seen the behind the scenes thing.
Yeah.
It's not that he doesn't have a reputation as a hard, being hard to work with.
Mm-hmm.
There's just been a few things where he's had, bad days and unfortunately was caught on film, that kind of thing, which does happen. But in general, he's not considered like a problem or anything like that.
Especially, specifically, if I talk about him on the Terminator movie and what was caught from that off camera and everything.
Yeah.
He is noted, one, he was in character when he's doing it, and he's a bit of a method actor.
Mm-hmm.
He is also kind of really, before people were apologizing just to apologize, kind of really owned this and said, mm-hmm. I could be a jerk sometimes, and I'm sorry. and I think that helps. It doesn't make up for being a jerk, but it does help a little bit, whether it's people coming to see your movies or people that want to work with you or
mm-hmm.
One of the dangerous things as an actor, you could be the most talented actor in the world. Russell Crowe found this out, but if people don't want to work with Like, oh, who signed up for that movie? Oh, him? Oh, I don't want to work with him.
No, thanks.
And that directors, producers don't like that. They don't like that very much.
No, they do not. They do not.
The whole reason I'm not a diva is just so people will work with me.
Otherwise, he'd just drop of a hat. He'd just be doing it.
In my head. Oh, I'm such a diva. Joking. I wouldn't even. I don't even know if I could play a diva. I'm a darn good actor, I think, but I'm not sure I could do that. Well, maybe I
could. You could do it.
I've done similar things.
You're not a method guy. You could do it.
Whether Arsenic and Old Lace or Equilibrium, whatever it might be, we encourage you to check out these movies and certainly let us know the movies you would like us either to talk about or you would like to talk about. Well, you know, I'm even open for that.
Exactly. And I think we're the idea here is that we're going to be doing this a little bit more if time and, you know, depends. It all really depends on the number of guests we have and that kind of stuff. So we'll be looking to do this a little bit more. I'm sure we get how many movies there's, you know, until we do every single film ever. No, I'm
ever.
Just kidding.
We were starting with the A's.
Yeah, that's right.
Got arsenic in.
That's true. Then we jump to E. Ruined it already. This is something like, and I think we were very curious about what people think too about what they movies that we can talk about, or if they are brave enough, they want to come on. Hey, we will invite you on, and we can talk to you about whatever, you know, film it is you want to talk about. You know, Ernest Goes to Jail. We'll even do that.
The Police Academy movies. Nobody's ever dissected those.
No.
For a reason.
No, they should be dissected in that way. But no, I'm kidding. There's people out there who love them anyway.
Yeah.
Hey, man, if it weren't for that, now I forget the name.
Michael Winslow?
The guy that always played the cop, I forget his last name, who has ever since then has never played anything but a cop.
Yeah.
Hey, man, that's career stability, though.
Definitely.
I mean, I'm sure he doesn't mind playing a cop all the time.
Those Police Academy movies made Steve Guttenberg a star. It's a name that you just don't hear it often enough. Steve Guttenberg. Didn't have that on my director's cut bingo card.
Not
I did
today.
Not know we were going to be mentioning him. Good show.
That's a good one.
Thank you so much for joining us, everybody. We greatly appreciate you guys. Spread the word about the show. Of course, if you have missed any shows, you can find all of our shows podcasted at civicmedia.us under shows. Go under Director's Cut and share these on your pages, your Facebook pages, your social media accounts. Spread the word about the show so we can get more and more guests on. We greatly appreciate every one of you doing that.
All right, everyone, that's going to wrap up the show for today. We will see you next week here on Director's Cut on WFHR.